LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is David Fridley of the Post Carbon Institute, who joins us to discuss renewable energy technology and the future of industrial civilization. In the face of depleting fossil fuel reserves, renewable energy sources are held up as the best hope for clean, green, and truly sustainable future societies. Upon closer investigation, however, solar, wind, and hydropower are much more limited in scope than we like to believe, making business as usual in the coming decades impossible using renewables alone. Renewable technologies deliver much less surplus energy than conventional means, and the tendency to construct installations such as solar arrays and wind farms on a massive scale is a symptom of outmoded thinking with many unintended side effects. Even if it were possible to convert the world to renewables, the effort in itself would burn through massive quantities of fossil fuels with potentially disastrous results. Biofuels, fracking, and nuclear power also come with their own lists of drawbacks and disadvantages. From food price spikes and environmental degradation, to the seemingly insoluble problem of storing and processing spent nuclear fuel, future reliance on any or all of these seems totally unrealistic. Meanwhile, major breakthroughs in more exotic technologies such as thorium and hydrogen always seem to be just around the corner and have yet to arrive on a genuinely large scale. But as we face a future in which we have less and do less, and the creed of endless economic growth finally crumbles, the prospect of a fairer and happier world may move just a little bit closer. Hello and welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
My pleasure.
David, today we're going to be talking about renewable energy, green energy, whatever you want to call it, the hopes for it, the promise that some say it holds, but also the limitations it may have and what these mean for the future of our industrial civilization. Before we get into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the work that you do.
Well, currently I'm a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, in the energy field, in the environmental technologies area. I'm also concurrently a fellow with the Post Carbon Institute in Santa Rosa, California. I've worked in the energy field for about 30, 35 years. A lot of my focus has been on China, China's energy development and energy efficiency, and it's a focus I work on now. And about 10 years ago, I also, from the concern over the situation with oil depletion, began looking more in depth at the issue of energy alternatives and their feasibility for substitution.
Now, of course, discussion about energy is, we hear every day in the media, whatever form it takes, whatever position it's coming from, whatever bias there is there. The bottom line, really, and this is the elephant in the room that's not really being discussed, is that we cannot have business as usual using renewable energy. That is to say, even if somewhere down the line we transition almost completely to renewables, the world's not going to look like it does now. It just can't be done.
That is the reality that is discussed only in very narrow quarters, yet it's the reality we face. I think in the world today, part of the challenge in understanding that is that we generally suffer from a great deal of energy illiteracy. People don't understand what energy is, nor do they really understand where it comes from, how it functions. Issues such as energy quality, conversion, losses, payback, and so forth. And so you end up with a situation where people's aspiration is business as usual, and the aspiration is to be hopefully fulfilled by substituting what we have now with a renewable energy future. But that's, in my view, just an aspiration. It's a bit of magical thinking to think that we can take a global energy system that's over 450 exajoules in size, convert it completely to renewable energy sources, and maintain the level of complexity and specialization that we have today, because the underlying physics of the energy involved just simply can't support that.
One point you make there about people not understanding what energy is, a lot of the discussion about this talks about techno fixes, you know, that technology will do this, that, the other thing. But it seems a very obvious point to make, but technology is not energy. But I think people get it wrapped up in their heads that, you know, because technology has done so much so far, and you also mentioned the issue of complexity, but we're already running into problems with our society in terms of, you know, having a technological problem and fixing it with more technology. But when you take that into the energy realm, again, it's another reason why this, you know, this, the model we have now can't just be flipped over and adapted to use renewables.
That's correct. I think, you know, we do live in a society in which an enormous amount of faith is put on technology to provide a solution to any problem that we identify. I mean, one problem with that is that, you know, not all problems have a solution. We actually are in a situation with energy where it's more of a dilemma. There's really no way out of this fix of the ongoing depletion of our fossil fuels in on top of the problem of having to deal with the emissions from fossil fuel and the climate change issue. Technology is not a source of energy. Technology is not energy. Technology ultimately allows us to consume energy sometimes more efficiently, and the confusion usually lies there. Technology is something that we have harnessed to allow us to mobilize a much huger volume of energy for our own consumption, and to pin our hopes on doing more of the same to shift our energy future is certainly misplaced.
Now, you used the word efficiency there, and that really has a lot behind it if you start to probe that, because people will say, oh, well, you know, this, the new cars are more energy efficient, more fuel efficient, and the new consumer durables are more energy efficient. And this is always seen as a good thing. And it is. But that what that often means is that more energy in total gets consumed. It's a strange little sort of conundrum, a strange little paradox.
Yes, that's, you know, that's an issue that people don't really fully appreciate. I actually work in an area where efficiency is the key focus of many people's research. And what you find is that in describing the impact of efficiency, the box around efficiency is drawn quite narrow. So, for example, a refrigerator might be twice as efficient as it was in 1980, and that's certainly the case here in the United States. And it's presented as if it has saved an enormous amount of energy. And it is true. To provide refrigeration services, we simply don't use the same amount of energy as we did before. But that's not where efficiency ends. Efficiency with respect to the humans that engage in it is really a method to save money. Even the U.S. Energy Star program doesn't tout the energy part of its efficiency label as much as it says, you know, save the world, save money. And what that money does in turn is mobilize more energy consumption, but in a completely different field. And that's not captured when these kind of analyses on efficiency is done. That's kind of the macro impact of efficiency, is to liberate money to go do more consumption. And consumption ultimately is based upon energy consumption. So, you know, there's really only one way to sterilize that impact, and that is when efficiency is a tactic to deal with rising prices. If you consume the same amount of energy, or if you consume half the amount of energy that you were before, but prices have doubled, you're not saving money. You're just keeping yourself flat. And in that case, you're actually not creating those knock-on effects from the efficiency impact. But yet that's not really the case, that's not really the case in most cases, where efficiency actually does save you a great deal of money. You can look at, you know, moving from an SUV to a hybrid car. You may save $30 every time you fill up your tank. That money just doesn't sit there. It goes out and does something, and it's usually in form of consumption. And whether you consume food or clothing or travel or whatever, the foundation under all of that is energy consumption. So, yes, efficiency doesn't necessarily lead to a reduction in energy use. And in fact, on a macro level, we don't have any cases where efficiency as a strategy has been able to reduce energy consumption. It may slow the growth of energy consumption in some cases, but we haven't seen it reduce it.
One comment I've heard made more than once to try and throw some light on this efficiency question is just people saying that the Nazis were very efficient. Just because something is efficient doesn't mean it's good.
Well, yes, and that's the case. I think if you look even at in a much broader sense about how humans live and use energy on Earth, you know, we are just part of an ecosystem which has been around for hundreds of millions of years. And we all now realize that even in our own ecology economy, we need to build these measures of resiliency that will allow us to adapt and deal with issues such as climate change or energy volatility or so forth. However, what you find is that the practices in nature that allow nature to be so resilient to survive, you know, flood and drought and cold and fire and these changes over time, is very low levels of efficiency and very high levels of redundancy. And that's exactly what today we're trying to push out of our society. We're trying to make a society that is not redundant, that's through the, you know, practice of specialization. Everyone has a specialized skill these days. And second, through efficiency, by getting the absolute maximum we can out of any unit consumption of energy. But what that creates is a situation of great vulnerability and great, sensitivity to disruption. Nature doesn't collapse when one item that it relies upon is withdrawn from an area. Our human society quickly collapses if, let's say, transport links to bring food to stores disappear. That kind of lack of redundancy and over-efficiency, indeed, is not always a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that people can do to analyze a situation for themselves, is look for incidences of those sorts of things coming up. For example, when it comes to the economy, you know, don't pay any attention to, for the most part, to what your politicians or mainline economists are saying. You know, look at the actual numbers for yourselves, you know, do your own due diligence. And it's the same comes here, really. And if we begin to see problems with the energy systems, you know, at large, that'll be signs that, I mean, how the politicians will go about ignoring them, I'm sure, but that'll be signs that some of these breakdowns, some of these stresses are beginning to, you know, cracks are beginning to show.
That's true, and I think that at the ground level, people are becoming more and more aware that maybe broadly speaking, something is wrong. The stressors are everywhere, despite the massive amount of climate denial that still exists in the United States. People do take notice when the intensity of hurricanes increases, or the number and intensity of tornadoes increases, or even here in California, we're now in our fourth year of a historic drought. You know, it's very difficult to say this is just a natural order of things. And I think, you know, politicians do us a disservice because they're not here to look out after our long-term interests. Their interests are very narrowly scoped in terms of their term in office. And I think that conflict between our long view of what life on Earth is going to be this century and the narrow view of the next 2 years in the House of Representatives sets us up to be disturbed by those kind of attitudes.
The fact that so many people are unable to imagine in the future having less or doing less, you know, against a background of, you know, constrained energy resources, it leads to this idea that, you know, they, I often invoke on here, you know, quote unquote, they will do something about it. Like we talked about earlier, you know, that technology will come along. We're seeing more and more renewable energy going in every year overall, I think. So the assumption is there that we'll somehow get through this. And the idea that there's this green technology in the pipeline has another kind of paradoxical or ironic effect, that there's almost like less incentive to reduce consumption, you know, whether that's material things or whether it's energy, because the idea is being that this cannot go away, so therefore it will be fixed. Yes, we realize there's some problems, but, you know, we don't have to do anything now because tomorrow, next week, next year, some amazing new device will pop up.
That, to me, does characterize many people's thinking about the world, and it comes down to something very simple, is that people simply do not want to be inconvenienced. But the problems that we are facing today are going to be ultimately highly inconvenient. People still would prefer to have the magical thinking that a technology, a new approach, something will be out there to allow them to continue on with life as they know it. People generally don't feel like they have control. If you listen to news interviews with people at the gasoline station, they rail against the price by talking about, you know, big oil or the Middle East or OPEC or something like that. These are all things way beyond their control. And people like to feel that the things in their life that they can manage somehow. It's going to be very difficult to get some kind of a voluntary movement away from overconsumption towards conservation and doing without. Yet I think it's going to be either our choice to do it or it's going to be imposed upon us. That suggests, a famous phrase by the first Energy Secretary of the United States, James Schlesinger, who said at one point that Americans only have two modes of action. One is complacency and the other is panic. We're certainly in the complacent phase today, and that's being, you know, even strengthened and built upon by a energy reporting agency and a media who want us to believe that this shale boom that's going on in the U.S. Is not only sustainable, but will continue to grow for the next 25 years. People are seeing lower prices at the pump today. And so there is this wider spread sense of complacency. That's not true among the people who have already been disadvantaged by this entire economic energy turmoil of the first decade of this century, who have, been knocked off the ability of widespread consumption, whose incomes are stagnant or have disappeared. Those people are feeling it already. In the UK, in the US, Canada, Japan, the rest of the EU, people are wealthy enough that these kind of inconveniences are not going to be felt evenly or at the same time, depending on basically your income class. But it's going to happen, just as our shale boom is, as one of our recent Post-Carbon Institute publications has shown, is a short-term phenomenon. And as the IEA, in their latest World Energy Outlook, has also warned that we face even greater oil market turmoil with the passing of the shale bubble, people just don't want to pay attention to that now. There's enough stressors in their personal life about employment or unemployment and income and paying for school and the rising price of food and things like that, that energy becomes an overwhelming topic because it's just not well understood.
Well, you mentioned that people having changes, reduced consumption forced upon them. One thing that pops to mind in terms of how that's responded to is in the wake of the financial crash of 2008, we saw government schemes. There was a famous one in Germany. There might have been something similar in the US where the government got people to trade in their cars and there were very favorable deals to get new ones. And that was a response to people not buying enough new cars.
That was almost global in reach. I mean, in China, which is the largest appliance producer in the world and one of the largest exporters of appliances, including refrigerators, air conditioners, and so forth, their industry was so hard hit by the global downturn after 2008 that they adopted a similar approach. They, subsidized considerably the purchase of more efficient refrigerators, more efficient air conditioners, and they for urban residents, and they had a separate program for rural residents to subsidize sometimes the first purchase of these appliances. And so, therein is another paradox in that even though the stated goal, of course, is considered to have been a good one, that is to encourage the adoption of more efficient technology, you also had a situation where people who may not have even bought an appliance to begin with were provided with the wherewithal to do so, and thus adding to even more energy consumption. But it was because the sector, the appliance sector in China, was so badly hit that this was a way to keep that sector's economic situation more stable.
I think people are quite used to the idea because it's been talked about for years, particularly since the advent of plastics, about how the oil is in everything. Never mind even things that apparently don't have oil in them. There's certainly oil behind that process somewhere, whether it's manufacture or transportation. And it should be no surprise, though I think this is something, again, that people don't really think about, but it should be no surprise that there's a lot of oil and other fossil fuels needed to go into to manufacture renewable technology and to convert to some form of renewables or, various, a sort of a basket of them in some sort of wholesale way. To attempt to do that on a very big scale globally is going to use enormous quantities of fossil fuel. So perhaps you give us your thoughts on that. And also, I'll just throw in at this point net energy, which is relevant to this process. Again, it's another concept that's not understood.
Yes, I think those are two very key concepts. Oil is indeed behind everything, and that's because we have to move everything. Oil is very dense and is very portable, and that allows us to do things in places where other forms of energy just can't do it. One of the definitions that I assert when talking about what is a renewable world going to look like is that the fact that it is not going to be a renewable world until the renewable energy technologies can replicate themselves. And that, at this point, is absolutely impossible. Be it from, for example, the neodymium used in the magnets in wind turbines that are mined using, you know, oil-driven equipment in Inner Mongolia and processed using coal in smelters and then shipped using oil to a manufacturer, and so forth. That's just one small example about how fossil fuels is the foundation of all renewable energy technology today. And currently, until for example, a solar PV panel factory can, you know, mine its raw materials using solar electricity and build the factory using solar electricity and create the machine tools using solar electricity and on down the line to produce more solar panels, that industry is not self-replicating. It's a fossil fuel-based industry. I remember a number of years ago in the UK, there was a trucker strike, and the one of the impact of that was there were no diesel deliveries being made, and I believe the UK came very close to a bit of an oil shortage. And I recall the first article I read about that is how a huge windmill, a wind farm in Scotland, had been shut down because there was no diesel to run the equipment to build it. And that really demonstrates, you know, how dependent we are on that fossil fuels to be able to create these technologies. And you're correct. If we were to do, as many people suggest, to replicate, say, a Marshall Plan size push to renewable energy construction and installation, we would, in essence, create this pulse of carbon on top of everything else that we're doing, because all those activities are fossil fuel based. You mentioned, you know, the energy return issue, and you know, that's also something where I think the dominance of economic thinking in the world has really hindered our ability to truly understand the implications of what a low energy return on investment means. The only energy that's useful to us is the energy that's not used to create energy. And that is the concept of net energy, or the energy profit. And that ratio to the total amount of energy created is this energy return on investment. And it's this, you know, this energy profit, that's what's left over after energy is used, is what we use to run the world. That's what we use to run factories and buildings and cars and everything else. And that surplus is generated because we were able to tap in to this massive amount of stored solar energy that nature had helpfully created for us over hundreds of millions of years. And now we're moving to a situation where that natural store of dense solar energy is trying to be replicated by a manufactured equipment using the current flux of energy received from the sun or from the wind. And that's, you know, that has significant implications. One is, for example, when we mine stored energy from the ground, we can mine it at the rate that we want when we want it. When we move to this manufactured energy capturing the current flux of solar or wind power, then we can only capture it and use it when it's happening at the rate of the flux. It's for example, the difference between having a huge, a trust fund in the bank where you can just take out as much money as you want and spend it as you want, compared to living off your current income week to week, where you can't spend more than you make. And that's the same with true with renewable energy. We can't consume more than we make if that's our only source of energy and we forego or no longer have access to these stores of energy. On top of that, we have the issue is that the profit of energy from each of these renewable technologies, because they're no longer provided to us free from nature, but are actually a conversion that's a conversion technology that's manufactured, all of those have energy requirements on the input side. And so the amount that you get out on the other end is much less as a ratio of the whole than what we've historically been able to get from coal or gas or from oil. You know, for example, PV panels, you know, generally take, you know, provide only about anywhere between 8 and 10 units of energy out for every unit gone in, compared to even oil today at about 30 units out to in, and coal today at 50 to 80 units out for one unit in. And that means that for every unit of energy spent, we just don't get as much energy profit. And if you don't get as much energy profit, you're going to have more of your activity oriented towards making energy if you want that same amount of energy available to run your society. And so it's a big, you know, topic of debate, but there is the issue of how much energy profit do we need to be able to sustain the complexity and the specialization of current modern industrial society. And, you know, it's an issue fraught with methodological challenges, but you know, Charles Hall and some of his people have at least made an attempt at suggesting that we have to have at least 5, probably 8 or 10 units of energy profit for every unit of energy we expend to be able to maintain this level of complexity. And that's a level of profit that's just not seen, for example, in the liquid alternatives, such as biodiesel or cellulosic ethanol or grain ethanol, or even the Canadian tar sands don't reach that level of profit. So it's not having a liquid that's ultimately going to provide us the alternative. It's having a liquid or alternative fuel that's available in the quantity needed at the energy profit needed to maintain complexity of modern industrial society.
Ethanol and biodiesel, I mean, that whole area of exploration has already proved of enormous unintended side effects and problems associated with it. Not least the, you know, energy return on investment isn't what it's cracked up to be. And what it boils down to, it seems, in the medium to long term with that is, do you want to drive or do you want to eat?
Yes, and that's true. It's become very obvious that when you try to use a arable land in a world of 7 billion people, in which all the best arable land has already been taken, if you're going to divert that land to another use, then there are trade-offs that are going to be had. Another trade-off is as we saw with the ethanol market, is you've created a linkage between the energy pricing mechanism and the food pricing mechanism. When a farmer can sell his corn only to the food market, food prices dominate. When the farmer has an option of selling it to an ethanol producer or to a food market, then he can be a price taker with the energy market. And when that is the mechanism that then transmits energy prices into the food prices. And we saw that dramatically back in 2008, and we saw it several years ago as well. Ultimately, the issue there is that none of these other sources, such as grains or even woody plant matter, have the energy density that fossil fuels have. And the consequence of a low energy density is a high consumption of materials. And we see this in the, you know, in the case of grains for, you know, corn ethanol, for example, in this country, where 40% of the corn grown in this country go to provide just 10% of the liquid that's in our gasoline pool, and a much lower percentage of what's in our total, less than 5% of our total oil pool. And yet we're using 40% of the corn crop to do that. Another example, you know, is the hope people have that we can just convert over to electric vehicles and that will solve the problem of the liquid fuels, even though, you know, in this country, gasoline is only 40% of our oil consumption. And in many countries like China, it's only 20% of their oil consumption. So just dealing with cars isn't going to solve a problem. But in that is how many people see the issue of energy, is their car and their lights. And so in cars, you know, there has been a growth of electric vehicles available. The technology has certainly been spurred, for example, by Tesla and the cars that they have put out onto the market. There's, you know, problems with electricity adoption in that you've got to have a place to charge it, and charging is not as quick as just filling your car up. But if you look at the issue of energy density, what electric cars rely upon is batteries. And batteries are really important for providing us a way to store electrical energy, which otherwise can't be stored, unlike oil or coal or natural gas. But if you look at their, you know, the Tesla today, they have this new Model S out that is one of their longer range cars on energy or on electricity. And the battery pack in that thing weighs, you know, over 600 kilograms. You know, that's over a half a ton of battery in your car. And that battery contains 85 kilowatt hours of electric energy. But if you compare that to, for example, for a typical, let's say, small car, a sedan, a compact car, probably more of them in the UK than here, but you might have a 10-gallon gasoline tank, and that 10 gallons weighs 62 pounds, or, you know, about, 25 kilograms or so. But that 25 kilograms compared to the 600 kilograms for the Tesla contains the equivalent of 360 kilowatt hours of energy, and which is why for just a little bit of weight, added weight in your car, you can go 400 to 500 miles. Obviously, electric motors are much more efficient than internal combustion engines. And yes, there are those trade-offs there. But the bottom line is that's an enormous amount of material resources needed to provide a single battery for a single car. So when you're talking over a half a ton of battery material, you're talking these days about lithium. That is the most advanced battery we have. And the lithium-based batteries have an energy density somewhere about 0.4, 0.5 megajoules per kilogram. And that's in comparison to gasoline, which has like 46, 47 megajoules of energy per kilogram. So, you know, there's 100 times difference in the density, which doesn't make up for the greater efficiency of electric motors over internal combustion engines. Any of these technical approaches can be demonstrated to be feasible at a small scale. Obviously, the Tesla Model S is, it may not be the most economic car, but it's technically feasible and it's commercial and it's available. And it has this 600 kilogram lithium ion battery in it. But what most people fail to appreciate is that you can't simply multiply that by a billion and say that we can convert our entire global transportation fleet to electricity. It's, you know, very simply put, the issue of scale. And scalability is another big weakness of these alternative energy approaches, simply because they are materially dense and are essentially, you know, a manufactured good. There's been a number of studies that have been released in the last few years looking at the world in 2050 and how we can reduce emissions to, you know, close to zero by electrifying everything. And they put out these, you know, very impressive spreadsheets and analyses that show how all this is going to happen. And all of them, and I believe this too, that if you're going to push carbon out of the transportation sector and deal with the issue of oil depletion, then it has to be electrified. In all studies but one, the issue is simply how much money is going to be spent. There was a study several years ago from Ecofisc, which is an environmental think tank in the Netherlands, which also dealt with this same issue of converting to a renewable world by 2050, but they admitted that, you know, there was a problem with lithium supply. Is there going to be enough lithium in the world to be able to make all the batteries to run all the cars in the world? They raised the question and then immediately dismissed it by saying it was outside the scope of the study. And still in the end, like all the other studies from Stanford and these other think tanks, simply asserted that this much money would provide us with a renewable world. The problem with that kind of an approach, of course, is, you know, money is an energy. Money is a marker that we use to distribute resources and to mobilize resources. And it's the underlying resources that people fail to think about in great depth, such as the availability of cheap lithium to make the number of batteries that would be needed to run a global transport system. People sometimes confuse the sufficiency of money, which we've seen in the last few years, of course, can be printed in virtually any quantity we want, with the sufficiency of the underlying resource that money is intended to mobilize. And I think that is a great weakness and shortcoming in looking at strategies for moving towards a world of greater renewable energy availability.
Just a quick thought on cars. I've not looked at any figures for purely electric vehicles like the Tesla, but I did read an article about the Prius and how actually, you know, people buying that, one of those cars, that they may well see a saving. In fact, they should see a saving on their motoring costs, you know, year on year. But in terms of the energy used to manufacture that car, if they were concerned about that, they'd be better off just buying an old compact car and keeping that running. But you mentioned this question of the dollarization of everything, and I'm sure you've probably seen the movie 2012, this epic disaster movie, but at some point in that film, the great and the good realize what the world is facing, and they forget about the dollar cost of anything. They say, can we do this? Because a lot of things that get done or don't get done in the world is because of whether they can be afforded, quote unquote, in terms of money. So I do wonder at what point in the future, maybe this is already happening somewhere, I don't know, but that projects might begin to be initiated, not based on economics, but actually on need and on whether it can be done, physically done or not.
We may get to that point, but frankly, I can't give you any examples of note where that is the case. Certainly in this country, the price determines everything. Obviously, there are ways to offset the, let's say, uneconomicalness of certain approaches, and we do that through subsidization. And we do have policies of subsidization in certain cases. Probably the oldest running one in the United States is our oil depletion allowance, where we now rely about 20% of the oil produced in this country comes out of what's called stripper wells, which produce less than 10 barrels of oil per day. And the energy costs and the economic costs of running those wells in terms of diesel, electricity, and so forth is greater than the energy content of the energy produced and the financial value of the energy produced. And so we deal with that by giving these people tax write-offs to compensate them for that. We see it with electric cars today. They're wildly expensive for an average person. And yet, for example, here in California, if you buy a Prius plug-in hybrid, the state will send you a check for $1,500, and the federal government will allow you to write $3,500 off on your taxes. So today we're still at the point where those kind of actions are still mediated through some kind of financial compensation because it's been considered a matter of public policy. I've not seen any examples where it's a matter of public policy to do something that's completely uneconomic and the people doing it, which in this country would be the private sector, are not compensated for it.
So these stripper wells, I'm thinking I might have heard about this somewhere down the line, but so they're running wells that from an energy point of view, they'd be better off just shutting down.
Yes. But they don't shut down because we collectively as a society value liquid energy over solid or electrical or gas energy. And so the value of having additional liquid supply outweighs the fact that it's an energy sink. The only way that a society can support energy sinks is to have a substantial energy profit elsewhere that can be used to subsidize it, same as doing it financially. And we subsidize it through our cheap coal because we use that to generate electricity, and that electricity is what drives the motor that drives the pump that pumps this oil out. In a society where energy is tight, those kind of practices I don't think would be sustainable for very long.
That really is insane. I mean, 10 barrels a day, that sounds like one guy with an oil well in his backyard sort of thing.
That's precisely the case it is. I mean, if you drive through West Texas, you will see these, we call them nodding donkeys, just slowly going up and down and up and down and just producing a few barrels at a time. People have them in their backyard. They're in the middle of towns. You can even find them down in Long Beach, California, from the old oil fields that were booming there back in the 30s. And they're cleverly disguised within, building shells and things like that. But they're still operating because they, at least the operators, financially benefit from doing it.
Earlier, you touched on the issue of scale, and there's this notion, this popular notion, that everything has to be on a grand scale because that's how it's evolved to be so far with the energy, use. And whether it's solar or wind or hydro, you see these enormous schemes going into place in certain parts of the world. I will just say as a side note, though, I've noticed rather ominously the cancellation of some high profile large schemes. But this idea of scale has, all sorts of implications, not least of which I was sort of wryly amused to read a story that you may have noticed about birds being immolated while flying over these enormous solar arrays and out in deserts and what have you. Whereas there is some evidence, actually, that whatever the limitations of renewables, that things like, decentralized and local renewables can bring sort of quite, good benefits almost straight away. For example, like solar hot water heaters, if we all had one of those, that would be a good thing. And that would be relatively easy to start implementing. But the thinking is always big, simply because I guess they think, well, industrial society is big, our energy demands are enormous, so therefore any response to this has to be on a massive scale.
Yes, and you're touching upon I would say almost a philosophical difference between groups within the alternative energy world, between large centralized and industrial and small decentralized and local. And this has yet to play itself out. In this country, you know, it's, you see that same division where the, you know, on the one hand, you have those who are proposing these massive solar and wind farms, which obviously have to be sited where the resource is most plentiful, in places such as the desert Southwest or the windy high plains of Wyoming. But that's not where the demand centers are. So that energy has to be moved, and it would have to be moved in these large, high-capacity grid connections that would take it to Texas or Illinois or other places like that. All of this is a replication of the structure that we've seen with fossil fuels of large, centralized, complex, and thus very vulnerable and fragile to collapse. On the other hand, there are those who propose that energy should be adapted to what's most favorable for each location. Here in California, solar is very feasible simply because, you know, we have a Mediterranean climate in this, and it doesn't rain during the summer. So we have lots of sunshine, and solar is very beneficial here. There's wind resources elsewhere. There's water resources. There's even biomass resources in certain places like Upper New England, which may be a more feasible and reasonable way to provide for local resilience. These large, centralized, massive-scale, renewable systems simply aren't going to provide us with the resilience that's going to be needed in a world where energy is no longer plentiful and no longer available when we want it and how we want it. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons behind this philosophical difference is that we're used to a world in which our demand is being satisfied by supply at will. All of our demands are questioned. If we want to turn the light on at 3 a.m., we expect the electrons to be there. If we want to, you know, drive it at 4 a.m., we expect that the gasoline would be available at that time. In a more decentralized world of variable, intermittent, and chaotic energy forms like wind and solar, even hydro, we may have to shift that paradigm away from expecting our demand to be met at all points through supply to concentrating our demand to times when there is supply, where supply drives our consumption instead of our demand. That's going to be difficult, although some of the proposals for what we're calling smart grid tend towards that solution in that they mediate the demand by showing you how much it's costing you at any point during the day. So, for example, if the wind dies down and it's a cloudy day and you're simply not getting the solar or wind energy into the grid, your current electric price may be 4, 5, 6 times higher than what it would be during a time of surplus. And it's an attempt to shape behavior through price response that is what I've seen as kind of the first move towards shifting people away from just consuming what you want when you want.
Well, you mentioned earlier about a truly renewable world would be one where a renewable energy devices, resources, whatever, kind of replicated themselves. And that's completely common sense. But as things stand, we have this fossil fuel intensive set of processes for making renewables, whether it's, you know, the devices or producing the energy itself. Those won't last forever. I mean, I've seen, even in the city where I live, I've spoken to one early adopter of solar technology. I mean, he had panels decades ago, and they just, after about 20 years, he had to get new ones. If we don't make them using silver and oil and all the other stuff at the minute, non-renewable resources, what do we make our PV panels from 50 years from now, 100 years from now?
It's a good question, and no one has been able to answer your question. And it's usually put in, you would have to reinvest this much money in 20 years to get a new inverter or new solar panels, without any consideration of what that monetary investment means in terms of what the underlying resource requirement is. That is a huge conundrum. And, you know, I'll go back to that same point of, you know, a renewable world built on fossil fuels is not a truly renewable world, to suggest that there just may not be a way out of that, certainly not in the scale that we would expect such an energy system to provide energy.
A couple of the other things perhaps we should just briefly address, things that are held out, hopefully, should I say, for our energy use in the future. And the headline one, I suppose, is nuclear, though, of course, we've had nuclear energy for many decades now, and you only have to look at the history to see not only the enormous problems with it, to say nothing of Fukushima, etc., but the fact that no one has yet come up with a way to properly store or process the spent fuel. And that's a huge concern, but it's almost treated as like, oh, well, don't worry about it. You know, again, they, somewhere down the line, somebody's going to figure this out. You know, maybe they can fly it and dump it on Mars or something, but whatever it is, it's blue sky thinking. And the other one is hydrogen. And I'm reading almost on a weekly basis. Well, I'm not reading them actually, because they mostly turn out to be not what they say they are. But I'm seeing headlines almost on a weekly basis about whether it's a car or some other sort of device that runs on 100% water. And of course it doesn't.
Yes. Well, you know, chalk that up to headline writers and, you know, the fact that the media isn't going to sell something if they talk about, you know, the nitty gritty of what's actually going on. On the issue of nuclear, I simply don't think it's ever going to be, even economically, going to be affordable to do. You know, in this country, it just simply would not happen unless the government itself stepped in and guaranteed the investment. The private sector simply will not go forward with nuclear power. You're right. You cannot understate the problem of the full life cycle impact of having a nuclear power plant, including decommissioning and storage of the nuclear waste, not to even mention the problem of accidents during its operating life. And most of these studies I've seen about, you know, the benefits of nuclear power tend to end right before the decommissioning and waste storage issue. It's really the benefits of a safely operated nuclear power plant for, you know, so-called clean electricity. From a life cycle point of view, it's not that clean. It's not carbon-free, and it may not generate much of an energy profit once you take into account all of the energy and resources required through the decommissioning and waste storage phase. You'll read and read again that there are this approach and that approach to waste remediation. But unless something is commercialized and available in scale, they're simply that. They're just a news article. It's the same with hydrogen. We had a plan here under the previous governor to, you know, the hydrogen highway. You know, it obviously ran into a problem because where's the hydrogen going to come from? And second, hydrogen is really, really difficult to store. As the very smallest of the elements, it can get through virtually any metal. And so you have to have very specialized containers that can withstand both high pressure and maintain, store the hydrogen as well. But we don't have natural hydrogen. It has to be extracted from something, and it's through the process of electrolysis that you would extract it from water, and that requires energy. So there's energy losses at that phase, energy in transmission, energy in storage. Hydrogen itself is not an energy source. It's an energy carrier. So the energy it embodies is the energy that's been liberated through the expenditure of energy upstream. I always ask, if you're going to use that electricity to create hydrogen from water, wouldn't that electricity be better used directly for some other purpose within society, or even, electric trolleys or alternate uses, direct uses of the energy without going through all those stages of losses to bring energy into a vehicle as a fuel? I don't hold high hope on energy as becoming more than a niche fuel in certain places, simply because it is such an energy intensive process to be able to make it at any scale that would matter.
Also, if I remember my chemistry, hydrogen is incredibly volatile. And if you're driving around in a hydrogen powered car, you're basically driving around in a bomb.
Yes, there are conditions under which it would be very explosive. I mean, the same is true of 10 gallons of gasoline if it's combusted in a certain way. But I think, the safety aspect shouldn't be understated simply because the materials requirement for hydrogen storage and for safe use have yet to be perfected.
Just before we move on from the nuclear thing completely, I mean, these plants, what is it, 400 plus worldwide, something like that, will have to be decommissioned at some point anyway, no matter what our energy future is, because they just don't last forever. But they need to be, if we do have constrained energy, looking highly likely in the decades and the century ahead of us, we're going to have to manage the nuclear situation very carefully, because what would 400 nuclear power stations look like if they no longer have electricity going there to keep everything stable? 400 melting down nuclear power stations. I don't think it'll come to that, but there's going to be some tough decisions made, I think.
Yes, and I think we've punted those decisions off to the future, that we don't have that many examples of decommissioned power plants. We do have examples of destroyed power plants, such as Chernobyl or Fukushima, and those are generational in terms of oversight. I mean, a power plant that's shut down in the normal way will, of course, have its fuel rods removed, but it's still going to have a highly radioactive core, and that core just can't be, you can't build a wall around it and just leave it there. It essentially has to be encased in concrete, and it has to be encased in very thick concrete. And, concrete is a very strong substance, but it doesn't last forever either. All the concrete we use in the world has rebar embedded in it to give it tensile strength. And that rebar is made of steel, and that steel rusts, and it undermines the strength of the concrete. And even after 100 years, you're going to have problems. So it's a long-term problem, not only in, managing a decommissioned site, but the fact that you're encasing it and dealing with it with a material that doesn't have, centuries of lifetime behind it too.
I still get regular emails from listeners saying that I need to seriously discuss thorium. Now, I looked at this because I got, after a while of this happening, I went off and got some information about it. And my reading of it, and of course, it's a lot of these discussions about energy are wrapped up in all sorts of politics, personal and global, and it can muddy the waters a lot when you're trying to establish what the truth about something is. But I came away with the impression that if thorium was going to be viable, it would have been done by now.
It's yet another one of those things, kind of like fusion, where the expectations that it will be viable is somewhere 20 years in the future, and that keeps ratcheting out 20 years every 20 years that goes by. Part of this is, there is this techno-optimism that there's something that's going to work. Thorium ultimately is no different from any other power generation technology. It could be demonstrated on a small scale, but a small scale isn't going to do anything for us. The question you really have to ask is, if we're dealing with the issues of climate change and with energy depletion or fossil fuel depletion, then the question really is, how much do you need of what and by when? We don't have forever to deal with all of this. And we're in a favorable position now in which we still have sufficient fossil fuels to be able to start developing in a different direction and use those fossil fuels to build the foundations of a world that's going to be more largely renewable based. But if we wait 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we're not just talking about the supply of oil, gas, or coal available to do things, although it won't be the same as today. But, you know, ultimately, if the price rises too high, then it leads to the situation that we've seen several times before, that your complex economy collapses. We saw it in 2008 at $147 for oil. You can't just assume that the future of high-priced energy is going to look like today of lower-priced energy. And so I think the expectation put on thorium is misplaced simply because it's not at a position where it can provide 1,000 gigawatts of electrical power. It couldn't be built out that fast. You can't talk about thorium supply at that level of scale. So, you know, again, the bottom line is, what do we need, by when, and how much do we need? And those questions should be asked of any of these, you know, new promising technologies.
I'm sure you've probably been aware of Masdar City, which is this new development. I can't remember exactly which country it is in the Middle East, but it's one of the wealthy ones. And this has been developed as a sort of model potentially for the future as to what new towns and cities might look like, even though the reality is going to be that we're not going to be able to build all new settlements for people from scratch. We're going to be retrofitting and working with what we've got, whatever happens. But I watched a documentary about this project, and it just seemed to me, I liked a lot of the designs. A lot of the buildings are very pretty, and there was a lot of thought and creativity had gone into it. But within the first 5 minutes, I thought, this is not the answer. This may be something that will be standing there 100 years from now as a curiosity. You know, something that, oh, we thought we were going to do that, did we? You know, and they've already got problems out there. Not mentioned in this documentary because it was quite a sort of a, you know, bigging up the project. But I've heard people talking about how sand getting on top of the solar panels is already causing the amount of energy they produce to drop by significant amounts. So people actually have to go out there and brush the sand off. And that's just the beginning of the issues, really.
Yes, I have read about this city. It's very interesting in that they're trying to do something completely different and to experiment with new approaches. The intent of the city is to find this so-called sustainable city of the future. But I share your hesitation in seeing that in what's actually been done there. You know, people, the world is urbanized and our future is urbanized simply because we no longer have the spare land for everyone to be a farmers or to live out on the land. So the urban form is here to stay, but the urban form is, you know, it's not the most efficient form in terms of providing the various services that people need throughout their day. For example, mobility. People today, you know, cities are very oriented towards transit or driving. But mobility isn't limited to vehicles. It could be biking or walking as are other forms of mobility. And you know, certain large cities with big grid blocks just aren't, you know, suitable for walking. They need heat or climate conditioning of some way, particularly heat if it's in a cold climate. That can be provided in a certain way. They need a place to live. They need shelter. That can be provided in a certain way. And then beyond that, there's, you know, they need places to have their education, places to be sick, hospitals, and places to perform the work that they do in their specialized task, which are office buildings. And you look at all that collectively, and urban areas are, let's say, concentrated urban areas like New York or London are, or Paris, even better, are fairly efficient in terms that of the metric if you only look at per capita consumption of energy. People in these cities tend to use less than people who live in smaller towns, suburbs, or, you know, rural areas. On the other hand, that is all that's operational energy. That's not really, that doesn't include the embodied energy that created the urban form to begin with. And this is where I think Masdar also has a problem, is that there's an enormous amount of embodied energy within those structures, both in novel ways that they've been built and in some of the specialized technologies that they've deployed there. Beyond the embodied energy of the city, which in the U.S., the embodied energy of a building may only be 20% of its lifetime energy footprint. In other places, depending on, you know, the ultimate building lifetime, it may be as much as 30 or 40%. So there, you know, you've got to consider how much energy is embodied within the structures and the materials themselves of the urban form. But then beyond that, the whole purpose of a city is to hold humans. And this is where the whole idea of sustainability in my mind just falls apart, is that the embodied energy of the personal consumption of the people who live in these cities far outweighs the embodied and operational energy of the city itself. That includes the embodied energy of the food they eat, the clothing they buy, the electronics they buy, all of the services they consume. If you look at the embodied energy of all of that, it overwhelms everything else. And this is not appreciated, because the implication of that is that we shouldn't consume so much, and that's taboo. The second implication is, you know, maybe we should consume things that are more appropriate for where we live, instead of importing, you know, grapes from Chile in the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Maybe we just shouldn't eat grapes in the winter and eat them in, you know, summer and fall when they're available, which was the food system we had just 40 years ago. All of these approaches are very interesting in terms of giving us insights into the performance strengths and weaknesses of other ways of doing it. But ultimately, it comes down to the fact that we have 7 billion people consuming far more than the Earth can accommodate, and having passed the, you know, carrying capacity of the globe. So, you know, whether it's a New York City or whether it's a Houston, which is one of the most horrible examples of urban form, it matters less than the fact that we have built an economic system that is founded on the fact that these people are consuming and are going to need to consume more every year to keep that consumption metric, which we call GDP, rising. That's where I tend to, you know, lose interest in the story that places such as Masdar really represent our sustainable future, because it's not the form that we got to concern about being sustainable as much as it is consumption.
Yes, and perhaps that's an appropriate point on which to end for today, really, that to observe that we are got ourselves trapped in this perpetual growth model. And even though there are huge practical problems we're facing, one major problem is just in our own minds. It's a psychological problem around the question of what constitutes the good life. And I think not much will change, actually, until we literally get our heads around this.
I agree. I think we're dealing with something that is once in a multiple generation paradigm shift. And as you know, as we've seen with just in the area of scientific paradigms, those don't change until all the people who believe the old paradigm have essentially died out. And ultimately, it may come to that. We're going to live in a renewable future because that's all we're going to. You know, it's an imperative. How we're going to live is going to depend on a lot on decisions made today. But, you know, the current signs are such that people really haven't come to appreciate that transition yet, although I think it's going to become clearer.
David, tell listeners where they can find out a bit more about your work and that of your colleagues. I guess first place to stop is the Post Carbon Institute website, which has got lots of resources and links.
Yes, quite a bit. That's postcarbon.org, and that contains many, many publications free for the download and links to the 30 or so fellows who constitute kind of the think tank behind the Post Carbon Institute, as well as their work. More of my work is available also at LBL, Lawrence Berkeley Lab at china.lbl.gov.
Wonderful. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.